Hi, and welcome to the Kubernetes podcast from Google. I'm your host, Craig Box. I think what I actually like about computers is collecting things, information about things, pieces of information, never hoarded, always shared, but neatly sorted and in the right place. That is one reason I love databases like IMDb and MusicBrainz. What I don't like to do is write code. I'm not sure why. Perhaps I'm a more visual person. The metaphor of write, look at output, debug, test, I'm sure we can do better. A couple of years ago, there was an April Fool's Day joke about sheet ops and managing Kubernetes with a spreadsheet. Then, Daniele from Learn Kubernetes made an actual Google Sheets and kubectl mashup. I'm here to make the case that more APIs should expose themselves through the medium of the spreadsheet. I know how to do operations on the table, and I can instantly validate the result. I can say each row should be 7 more than the previous row, and then see, well, that doesn't account for the holiday break, correct the data once, and watch all the rest of the dates fix themselves. It's easy to see where you made a mistake, in your own data or versus another source. It's also really good if any of that data has to be manually entered or copied and pasted in from somewhere else. There's a reason they used to say Excel is the most common programming language in the world. I'm very good with a VLOOKUP and even occasionally write an array formula or two. Don't you tell me I'm not a programmer just because it's not written in Rust. Unit tests? Ha! What are they? Anyway, it's possible that I've just asked you to invent Airtable, but all I wanted to do was update a silly online listing of TV shows, and if only that exposed their API as a spreadsheet, I would have done it by now. Let's get to the news. Kubernetes 1.24 has been released. The first release of 2022 tracked 46 enhancements, 14 stable, 15 moving to beta, and 13 entering at alpha. A major removal is support for using the so-called Docker shim. Users who still haven't moved to Containerd or Cryo, even after all the blog posts, will be able to adopt a new CRI Dockerd driver. Listen on to learn more about the release. The Metaflow project is a Python data science library originally built at Netflix. Designed to move from prototype to proprietary AWS APIs, the project has this week announced support for targeting Kubernetes. Its chosen scale-out workflow engine is Argo Workflows, with integration work initially started by SAP. Savin Goyal, co-creator of Metaflow and co-founder of startup Outerbounds, picked up the project and announced production readiness of the service on the Argo project blog. Version 1.3 of KubeVila is out this week. KubeVila is the runtime for the open application model, developed by Alibaba with occasional involvement from Microsoft and Crossplane. New features are focused on multi-cluster delivery, a GUI dashboard, and the add-on ecosystem, and are derived from the in-depth practice of end users such as Alibaba, Line, China Merchants Bank, and ITE. Kubernetes continues its descent into the embedded space, with open-source consultancy Collabora announcing support for the automotive control framework CANbus. The Control Area Network, also known by former President Obama as the Yes We Can Bus, is supported in Linux, but didn't work in Kubernetes due to it not being based on TCP/IP. You can think of CAN drivers as being like GPUs, in that they are locally connected, virtualizable, and separate support is needed. That support has now been written as a device plugin, opening up support for debugging and testing vehicle software in containers. Armo, the company behind Kubescape, has announced a $30 million Series A round led by Tiger Global. Armo is committed to building and maintaining its Kubernetes security platform as 100% end-to-end open source, with a business model of providing hosting, starting at $59 per node per month. They intend to use the investment to grow internationally from their base in Tel Aviv. Fellow security vendor Aqua has published a 2022 report on cloud-native threats. Aqua's threat research team Nautilus say that actors' tactics, techniques, and procedures have been more sophisticated in the last 12 months, with backdoors and worms more common. They observed a broadening of targets from unprotected Docker API endpoints to Kubernetes and CI/CD environments, with software supply chain attacks up 300%. Team Nautilus also laments the purported retirement of hacking group Team TNT, which makes it sound like they used to play 8v8 Unreal Tournament against each other. The full report will cost your email address. A security issue was discovered in Ingress Nginx, where a user that can create or update Ingress objects is able to obtain the credentials of the Ingress Nginx controller. in the default configuration, that credential has access to all of the secrets in the cluster. A new Ingress Nginx version 1.2.0 contains fixes and workarounds for the issue, and you can learn more about Ingress Nginx in episode 162. Finally, and rounding out the security section, Mac Chaffee from the Renaissance Computing Institute has answered the 7-year-old question and come up with a threat model for Kubernetes secrets. He points out that to be useful, they have to exist in the memory of the process that is using them, and posits that all the protection you can give etcd, including encrypting it, is useless if the API server will just give you the key, or if you can read it from another process running on the same node. A great post with a compelling argument to just pack it all in and go live in the forest, really. Mac seems to blog exactly once per year, so we'll set a timer for the next post in 2023. And that's the news. James Leverack is a staff solutions engineer at Jetstack and the release team lead for Kubernetes 1.24, which launched this week. Welcome to the show, James.
Hey, it's great to be here.
Your journey to Kubernetes went through the fintech industry. Tell me a little bit about how you came to software.
I took a pretty traditional path to software engineering. I went through school and then I did a computer science degree at the University of Bristol. And then I just ended up taking a software engineer job from there. And somewhat rather by accident, I ended up doing fintech work, which is, you know, it's pretty interesting, pretty engaging. But in my most recent fintech job before I joined Jetstack, I ended up writing this, working on a software project that we needed Kubernetes to solve a technical problem. So we implemented Kubernetes, and as often happens, I ended up as the one person on the team that understood the infrastructure while everyone else was doing all of the application development. And I ended up enjoying the infrastructure side so much that I decided to move and do that full time. So I looked around and I found Jetstack, whose offices were literally across the road. I could see them out of our office window. And so decided to just hop across the road and join them and do all this Kubernetes stuff more.
What's the tech scene like in Bristol? You went there for school and never left?
Pretty much. It's happened to a lot of people I know and a lot of my friends. Is you go to university somewhere and you're just kind of stuck there forever, so to speak. It's been known for being quite hot in the area in terms of that part of the UK. It has a lot of tech companies. Obviously, there's a fintech I worked at before. I think some larger companies have offices there. For not London, it's not doing too bad, I don't think.
When you say hot, though, that's tech industry, not weather, I'm assuming.
Yeah, weather is the usual UK, just kind of a nice overcast and rainy, which I quite like. I'm quite fond of it.
Public transport good?
Buses are all right. We got a new bus installed recently, which everyone hated while it was being built, and now it's complete, everyone loves. So, standard, I think.
That is the way. As someone who lived in London for a long time, it's very easy for me to say, well, London's kind of like Singapore. It's its own little city-state. But whenever we did go out, that part of the world, Bath especially, is a very lovely town.
Oh, Bath's lovely. I've been a couple of times.
Have you been to Box?
To where, sorry?
There's a town called Box just outside Bath. I had my picture taken outside all the buildings, proclaim myself the mayor.
Oh, no, I don't think I have.
Well, look it up if you're ever in the region, everybody. Let's get back to Jetstack, though. They were across the road. Great company. The two Matts, the co-founders there. What was the interview process like for you?
It was pretty relaxed. One lunchtime, I just walked down the road and went to a coffee shop with Matt. And we had this lovely conversation talking about my background and Jetstack and what I was looking to achieve in a new role and all this. And I'd applied to be a software engineer. And then it kind of at the end of it, he looked over at me and was like, well, how about being a solutions engineer instead? I was like, what's that? And it's like, well, you know, it's just effectively being a software consultant. You're going to go, you help companies implement Kubernetes, use the thing, all that stuff you enjoy, but you do it full time. And I was like, well, maybe. And in the end, he convinced me. And I ended up joining as a solutions engineer with the idea that if I didn't like it, I could transfer to be a software engineer again. And nearly 3 years later, I've never taken him up on that offer. I've just stayed as a solutions engineer the entire time.
At the company you were working at, I guess you were effectively the consultant between the people writing the software and the deployment in Kubernetes. Did that make sense then for you to carry on in that role as you moved to Jetstack?
I think so. I think it's something that I enjoyed. Not that I didn't enjoy writing software applications. I always enjoyed it. And we had a really interesting product and a really fun team. But I just found that more interesting. And it was becoming increasingly difficult to justify spending time on it when we had an application to write, which was completely fine. And that makes sense for the needs of a team at the time. But it's not what I wanted to do.
Do you think that talks to the split between Kubernetes being for developers or for operators? Do you think there's always going to be the need to have a different set of people who are maintaining the running infrastructure versus the people who are writing the code that run on it?
I think to some extent, yes. Whether or not that's a separate platform team, or whether or not that is because the people running it are consultants of some kind, or whether or not this is kind of getting abstracted away from you in some of the more batteries included versions of Kubernetes, like especially some of the cloud hosted ones, somewhat remove that need. So I don't think it's absolutely necessary to employ a platform team, but I think someone needs to do it, or you need to implicitly or explicitly pay for someone to do it in some way.
In the 3 years you've been at Jetstack now, how different are the jobs that you do for the customers? Is this just a case of learning one thing and rolling it out to multiple people, or is there always a different challenge with everyone you come across?
I think there's always a different challenge. My role has varied drastically. So, for example, a long time ago, I did a Istio install, but it was a relatively complicated single mesh multi-cluster install. And that was before multi-cluster support was really as readily available as it is now. Conversely, I've worked building custom orchestration platforms on top of Kubernetes for like specific customer use cases. It's all varied, and every single customer engagement is different, which is an element I really like about the job, that variability in how things are and how things go.
When the platform catches up and does things like makes it easier to manage multi-cluster environments, do you go back to the customers and bring them up to date with the newest methods?
It depends. Most of our engagements are there to solve a specific problem. And once we've solved that problem, they may have us back. But typically speaking, in my line of work, it's not an ongoing engagement. There are some within Jetstack that do that, but not so much in my team.
Your bio suggests that you were once called the reason any corporate policy evolves. What's the story there?
I think I just couldn't leave things well enough alone. So I was talking to our operations director inside of Jetstack, and he once said to me that whenever he's thinking of a new corporate policy, he asks, will it pass the James Laverack test? And that is, will I look at it and find some horrendous loophole? So, for example, when I first joined, I took a look at our acceptable use policy for company equipment, and it stated that you're not allowed to have copyrighted material on your laptop. And of course, this makes sense. It's, you know, you don't want people doing software piracy or anything. But as written, that would imply you're not allowed to have anything that is copyrighted by anyone on your machine.
Such as perhaps the operating system that comes installed on that.
Such as perhaps the operating system or anything. And, you know, this clearly didn't make any sense. So I adjusted that, and I've kind of been fiddling with that sort of policy ever since.
The release team is often seen as an administrative role versus a pure coding role. Does that speak to the kind of change you've had in career between previously being a software developer and now being more of a consultant? Or was there something else that attracted you to get involved in that particular part of the community?
I wouldn't really consider it less technical. I mean, yes, you do much less coding. This is something that constantly surprises my friends and some of my colleagues when I tell them more detail about my role. There's not really any coding involved. I don't think my role has really changed to have less coding. In fact, one of my more recent projects at Jetstack, a client project, involved a lot of coding. But I think that what attracted me to this role within Kubernetes is really around the community. I found it really rewarding to engage with SIG release and to engage with the release team. So I've always just enjoyed doing it, even though there is, as you say, not all that much coding involved.
Indeed, your wife said to you, I don't think your job is to code anymore. You just talk to people all day. How did that make you feel?
Annoyed because she was right. This was kind of a couple of months ago when I was in the middle of it with all of the Kubernetes meetings. And also my client project at the time involved a lot of technical discussion. So I was in 3 or 4 hours of calls every day. And I don't mind that, but I would, you know, I would come out, part because of course you're working from home, so she sees me all the time. So I'd come out, I'd grab a coffee and be like, oh, I've got another meeting, I've got to go. And she'd be like, do you ever code anymore? I think it was, in fact, just after Christmas when she asked me, when was the last time you programmed anything? And I had to think about it, that I realized that perhaps there was a problem there. Well, not a problem, but I realize that perhaps I don't code as much as I used to.
Are you the kind of person who will pick up a hobby project to try and fix that?
Absolutely. I've recently started writing a Kubernetes operator for my Minecraft server. That probably tells you about the state I'm in.
If it's got Kubernetes in it, it doesn't sound that much of a hobby.
Do you not consider Kubernetes to be a hobby?
It depends.
I think I do.
I think by now.
In some extent.
You mentioned observing the release team and process before you decided to get involved. Was that as part of working with customers and looking to see whether a particular feature would make it into a release? Or was there some other reason that that was how you saw the Kubernetes community?
Just after I joined Jetstack, I got the opportunity to go to KubeCon San Diego. I think we actually met there.
We did.
Had dinner, didn't we? So when I went, I'd only been at JetStack for a few months. I really wasn't involved in the community in any serious way at all. And as a result, I just ended up following around my then colleague, James Munnelly. And James is lovely. And I, you know, just kind of went around with him because he knew everyone. And I ended up in this hotel bar with a bunch of Kubernetes people, including Stephen Augustus, the co-chair of SIG Release and a bunch of other roles within the community. And I happened to ask him, I want to get involved. What is a good way to get involved with a Kubernetes community if I've never been involved before? And he said, oh, you should join the release team.
So it's all down to where you end up in a bar with someone.
Yeah, pretty much.
If I'd got to you sooner, you could have been working on Istio.
Yeah, I could have been working on Istio. I could have ended up in some of the SIG doing something. I just happened to be talking to Stephen, and Stephen suggested it, and I gave it a go, and here I am 2 years later.
I think I remember at the time you were working on an etcd operator.
Yeah, that's correct. This was part of a client project, which they thankfully let us open source. This was a operator for etcd, which is, they had a requirement to run it in Kubernetes, which of course is the opposite way around to how you'd normally want to run it.
And I remember having you up at the time, like, I'm pretty sure those things exist already, and asking what the need was for there to be something different.
It was, they needed something very specific. The ones that existed already were all designed to run clusters that couldn't be shut down. So etcd, you know, as long as one replica stayed up, you could keep running etcd. But they needed to be able to suspend and restart the entire cluster, which means they needed disk persistence support, which it turns out is quite complicated.
It's easier if you just throw all the data away.
It's much easier to throw all the data away. So we needed to be a little bit careful about how we managed it. So we thought about forking and changing an existing one, but we realized it was probably just be easy to start from scratch. So we did that.
You've been a member of every release team since that point, since Kubernetes 1.18 in 2020, in a wide range of roles. Which set of roles have you been through?
I started out as a release notes shadow and did that for a couple of releases in 1.18 and 1.19. In 1.20, I was a release notes lead. And then in 1.21, I moved into being a shadow again as an enhancement shadow, for in 1.22, becoming an enhancements lead, but in 1.23, a release lead shadow, and then finally, in 1.24, release lead as a whole.
That's quite a long time to be with the release team. You're obviously going to move into an emeritus role after this release. Do you see yourself still remaining involved? Is it something that you're clearly very passionate about?
I think I'm going to be around in SIG release for as long as people want me there. I find it a really interesting part of community, and I find the people super interesting and super inviting.
Let's talk then about Kubernetes 1.24. First, as always, congratulations on the release.
Thank you.
This release consists of 46 enhancements. 14 have graduated to stable, 15 have moved to beta, and 13 are in alpha. 2 are deprecated, and 2 have been removed. How is that versus other releases recently? Is that an average number? That seems like a lot of stable enhancements, especially.
I think it's pretty similar. Most of the recent releases have been quite similar in how they, of the number of enhancements they have and in what categories. For example, in 1.23, the previous release, there were 47. I think 1.22 before that had 53, so slightly more, but it's around about that number.
You didn't want to sneak 2 extra in so you could say you were one more than the last one?
No, I don't think so. I think we had enough going on.
The release team is obviously beholden to what features the SIGs are developing and what their plans are. Is there ever any coordination between the SIG release process and the SIGs in terms of things like saying this release is going to be a catch-up release, like the old Snow Leopard releases for Mac OS, for example, where we say we don't want as many new features, but we really want more stabilization, and could you please work on those kind of things?
Not really. The cornerstone of a Kubernetes organization is the SIGs themselves, so the special interest groups that make up the organization. It's really up to them what they want to do. We don't do any particular coordination on the style of thing that should be implemented. And a lot of SIGs have roadmaps that are looking over multiple releases to try to get features that they think are important in.
Well, let's talk about some of the new features in 1.24. We have been hearing for many releases now about the impending doom, which is the removal of Docker Shim. It is gone in 1.24. Do we worry?
I don't think we worry. This is something that the community has been preparing for a long time. We've published a lot of documentation about how you need to approach this. And the honest truth is that most users, most application developers in Kubernetes will simply not notice a difference or have to worry about it. It's only really platform teams that administer Kubernetes clusters and people in very specific circumstances are using Docker directly, not through the Kubernetes API, that are going to experience any issue at all.
And I see that Mirantis and Docker have developed a CRI plugin for Docker anyway, so you can just switch over to that and everything continues.
Yeah, absolutely. Or you can use one of the many other CRI implementations. There are two in the CNCF, Containerd and Cryo.
Having gone through the process of communicating this change over several releases, what has the team learnt in terms of how we will communicate a message like this in future?
I think that this has been really interesting from the perspective of this is the biggest removal that the Kubernetes project has had to date. We've removed features before. In fact, we're removing another one in this release as well. But this is one of the most user-visible changes we've made. I think there are very good reasons for doing it, but I think we've learned a lot about how and when to communicate and the importance of having migration guides, the importance of having official documentation that really clarifies that thing. I think that's the real, it's an area in which the Kubernetes project has matured a lot since I've been on the team.
What is the other feature that's being removed?
The other feature that we're removing is dynamic kubelet configuration. This is a feature that was in beta for a while, but I believe we decided that it just wasn't being used enough to justify keeping it, so we're removing it. We deprecated it back in 1.22 and we're removing it this release.
There was a change in policy a few releases ago that talked about features not being allowed to stay in beta forever. Have there been any features that were at risk of being removed due to lack of maintenance, or are all the SIGs pretty good now at keeping their features on track?
I think the SIGs are getting pretty good at it. We had a spate of a long time when a lot of features were kind of perpetually in beta. As you remember, Ingress was in beta for a long, long time.
I choose to believe it still is.
So I think it's really good that we're moving towards that stability approach with inside Kubernetes. I think it's a very positive change.
The fact that Ingress was in beta for so long, along with things like the main workload controllers, for example, did lead people to believing that beta APIs were stable and production ready and could and should be used. Something that's changing in this release is that beta APIs are going to be off by default. Why that change?
This is really about encouraging the use of stable APIs. There was a perception, like you say, that beta APIs were actually stable. And because they can be removed very quickly, we often ended up in the state where we wanted to follow the policy and remove a beta API, but were unable to because it was de facto stable, according to the community. This meant that cluster operators and users had a lot of breaking changes when doing upgrades that could have been avoided. So this is really just to help stability as we go through more upgrades in the future.
I understand that only applies now to new APIs. Things that are in beta at the moment will continue to be available, so there'll be no breaking changes again?
That's correct. There's no breaking changes in beta APIs other than the ones we've documented this release. It's only new things.
Now, in this release, the artifacts are signed using cosine signatures, and there is experimental support for verification of those signatures. What needed to happen to make that process possible?
So this was a huge process from the other half of SIG release. So SIG release has the release team, but it also has the release engineering team that handles the mechanics of actually pushing releases out. They have spent, and one of my friends over there, Adolfo, has spent a lot of time trying to bring us in line with SALSA compliance. I believe we're looking now at level 3 compliance. SALSA is a framework that describes software supply chain security. And that is, of course, a really big issue in our industry at the moment. And it's really good to see the project adopting the best practices for this.
I was looking back at the conversation I had with Ray Lahano about the 1.23 release, and we were basically approaching level 2. We're now obviously stepping up to level 3. A thing I asked Ray at the time was, is it fair to say that SALSA is inspired by large projects like Kubernetes, and that in theory it should be really easy for these projects to tick the boxes to get to that level because the SALSA framework is written with projects like Kubernetes in mind?
I think so. I think it's been somewhat difficult just because it's one thing to do it, but it's another thing to prove that you're doing it, which is the whole point around these frameworks, is that assertion, that proof.
As an end user of Kubernetes, whether I install it myself or I take it from a service like GKE, what will this provenance then let me prove? If we put that in the orange juice example we talked to Santiago about recently, how do I tell that my software is safe to run?
So if you're downloading and running Kubernetes yourself, you can use the verifying image signatures feature to verify the thing you've downloaded and the thing you are running is actually the thing that the Kubernetes project has released. I mean, it has been built from the actual source code in the Kubernetes GitHub repository. This can give you a lot of confidence in what you're running, especially if you're running in a highly secure or regulated environment of some kind. As an end user, this isn't something necessarily that will directly impact you, but it means that service providers that provide managed Kubernetes options, such as Google and GKE, can provide even greater levels of security and safety themselves about the services that they run.
A lot of people get access to their Kubernetes server just by being granted an API endpoint and they start running kubectl against it. So they're not actually installing their own Kubernetes. They have a provider or a platform team do it for them. Do you think it's feasible to get to a world where there's something that you can run when you're deploying your workloads, which queries the API server, for example, and gets access to that same provenance data?
I think it's going to be very difficult to do it that way, simply because this provenance and attestation data implies that you actually have access to the underlying executables, which typically when you're running on a managed platform, you don't. So if you're having Kubernetes provided to you, I think you're still going to have to trust the platform team or the organization that's providing it to you.
Just like when you go to the hotel breakfast bar, you have to trust that they've been good with their orange juice.
Yeah, I think that orange juice example is great. If you're making it yourself, then you can use the attestation. If you're not, if you've just been given a glass, then you're going to have to trust who's pouring it.
Continuing with our exploration of new stable features, storage capacity and volume expansion are generally available. What do those features enable me to do?
So this is a really great set of stable features coming out of SIG storage. Storage capacity tracking allows applications on Kubernetes to use the Kubernetes API to understand how much storage is available, which can drive application decisions. With volume expansion, that again allows an application to use the Kubernetes API to request additional storage, which can enable applications to make all kinds of operational decisions.
SIG Storage are also working through a project to migrate all of their in-tree storage plugins out to CSI plugins. How are they going with that process?
In 1.24, we have a couple of them that have been migrated out. The Azure Disk and OpenStack Cinder plugins have both been migrated. They're maintaining the original API, but the actual implementation happens now in those CSI plugins.
Do they have a long way to go, or are they just cutting off a couple every release?
They're just doing a couple every release from what I see. There are a couple of others to go. This is really part of a larger theme within Kubernetes, which is pushing out application-specific things behind interfaces, such as the container storage interface and the container runtime interface.
That obviously sets up a situation where you have a stable interface and you can have beta implementations of that that are outside of Kubernetes and get around the problem we talked about before with not being able to run beta things.
Yeah, exactly. It also makes it easier to expand Kubernetes. You don't have to try to get code in tree in order to implement a new storage engine, for example.
gRPC probes have graduated to beta in 1.24. What does that functionality provide?
This is one of the changes that's going to be most visible to application developers on Kubernetes, I think. Until now, Kubernetes has had the ability to do readiness and liveness checks on containers and be able to make intelligent routing and pod restart decisions based on those. But those checks had to be HTTP REST endpoints. With Kubernetes 1.24, we're enabling a beta feature that allows them to use gRPC. This means that if you're building an application that is primarily gRPC-based, as many microservices applications are, you can now use that same technology in order to implement your probes without having to bundle a HTTP server as well.
Are there any other enhancements that are particularly notable or relevant perhaps to the work you've been doing?
There's a really interesting one from SIG Network, which is about avoiding collisions in IP allocations to services. In existing versions of Kubernetes, you can allocate a service to have a particular IP, or you can leave it blank and it will generate its own IP. This is the internal cluster IP I'm talking about. In Kubernetes 1.24, there's an opt-in feature, which allows you to specify a pool for dynamic IPs to be generated from. This means that you can statically allocate an IP to a service, and know that IP cannot be accidentally dynamically allocated. This is a problem I've actually had in my local Kubernetes cluster, where I use static IP addresses for a bunch of port forwarding rules. And I've always worried that during server startup, they're going to get dynamically allocated one of the other services. Now, with 1.24 in this feature, I won't have to worry about it anymore.
This is like the analog of allocating an IP in your DHCP server, rather than just claiming it statically on your local machine.
Pretty much. It means that you can't accidentally double allocate something.
Why don't we all just use IPv6?
That is a very deep question I don't think we have time for.
The margins of this podcast would be unable to contain it, even if we did. The theme for Kubernetes 1.24 is Stargazer. How did you pick that as the theme?
Every release lead gets to pick their theme, pretty much by themselves. When I started, I asked Ray, the previous release lead, how he picked his theme, because he picked the next frontier for Kubernetes 1.23. And he told me that he'd actually picked it before the release even started, which meant for the first couple of weeks and months of the release, I was really worried about it because I hadn't picked one yet and I wasn't sure what to pick. Then again, I was speaking to another former release lead and they told me that they picked theirs like 2 weeks out. So it seems to really vary. About halfway through the release, I had some ideas down. I thought maybe we could talk about... So I live in a city called Bristol in the UK, which has a very famous bridge. And I thought, oh, we could talk about bridges and architectural and a metaphor for community bridging gaps and things like this. And I kind of liked the idea, but it didn't really grab me. And one thing about me is that I am a serious night owl. I cannot work effectively in the mornings. I've always enjoyed the night. And that got me thinking about astronomy and the stars. And I think one night I was trying to get to sleep because I couldn't sleep. And I was watching PBS Space Time, which is this fantastic YouTube channel talking about physics. And I'm not a physicist. I don't understand any of the maths, but I find it really interesting as a topic. And I just thought, well, why don't I make the theme about stars? Kubernetes has often had a space theme in many releases, as I'm sure you're aware. Its original name was based off of Star Trek. The previous release had a Star Trek-based thing. I thought, well, let's do that. So I came up with the idea of Stargazer.
Once you have a theme, you then need a release logo. And I understand you have a household artist.
I don't think she'd appreciate being called that, but yes. So my wife is an artist, and in particular a digital artist. And I had a bit of a conversation with the SIG release folk to see if they'd be comfortable with my wife doing it. And they said they'd be completely fine with that. And so I asked if she'd be willing to spend some time creating a logo for us. And thankfully for me, she was. And she has produced this. Well, I'm somewhat obliged to say, but she produced this a beautiful logo, which you can see in our release blog and probably around social media, that is a telescope set over starry skies. And I absolutely love it.
It is objectively very nice. It obviously has the seven stars or the seven sisters of the Pleiades. Do the colors have any particular meaning?
So the colors are based on the Kubernetes blue. If you look in the background, that haze is actually in the shape of a Kubernetes wheel from the original Kubernetes logo.
You must have to squint at it the right way. Very abstract, as is the want of art.
As is the want.
You mentioned before Ray Lahano, the 1.23 release lead. We ask every interview what the person learnt from the last lead and what they're going to put in the proverbial envelope for the next. At the time, Ray said that he would encourage you to use teachable moments in the release team meetings. Was that something you were able to do?
Not as much as I would have liked. I think the thing that I really took from Ray was communicate more. Mm-hmm. I've made a big effort this time to put as much communication in the open as possible. I was actually worried that I was going to be spamming the SIG release Slack channel too much. I asked our SIG release chairs, Stephen and Sasha, about it, and they said, just don't worry about it. Just spam as much as you want. And so I think the majority of the conversation in SIG release Slack over the past few months has just been me. That seems to work out pretty well.
That's what it's for.
It is what it's for, but SIG release does more than just the individual release process, of course. It's release engineering, too.
I'm sure they'd be interested in what's going on anyway.
It's true. It's true. It's been really nice to be able to talk to everyone that way, I think.
We talked before about your introduction to Kubernetes being at a KubeCon and meeting people in person. How has it been running the release almost entirely virtually?
It's not been so bad. The release team has always been geographically distributed, somewhat by design. So it's always been a very virtual engagement. So I don't think it's been impacted too much by the pandemic and travel restrictions. Of course, I'm looking forward to KubeCon Valencia and being able to see everyone again, but I think the release team has handled excellently in the current situation.
What is the advice that you will pass on to the next release lead, which has been announced to be CC Huang from Google?
I would say to CC that open communication is really important. I made a habit of posting every single week in SIG release a summary of what's happened, and I'm super glad that I did that, and I'm going to encourage her to do the same if she wants to.
This release was originally due out 2 weeks earlier, but it was delayed. What happened?
That delay was the result of a release blocking bug, an absolute showstopper. This was in the underlying Go implementation of TLS certificate verification, and it meant that a lot of clients simply would not be able to connect to clusters or anything else. So we took the decision that we can't release with a bug this big, so that's the term release blocking. The fix had to be merged upstream in Go 118.1, and then we had to, of course, rebuild and release candidates. And given the time we like to have things to sit and stabilize after we make large changes like that, we felt it was more prudent to push out the release by a couple of weeks than risk shipping a broken 0.0.
Go 118 is itself quite new. How does the project decide how quickly to upgrade its underlying programming language?
A lot of it is driven by support requirements. So we support each release for three releases. So Kubernetes 124 will be most likely in support until this time next year in 2023, as we do three releases a year. That means that right up until May 2023, we're probably going to be shipping updates for Kubernetes 124, which means that the version of Go we're using and other dependencies have to be supported as well. My understanding is that the older version of Go, Go 117, just wouldn't be supported long enough. So for any underlying critical bug fixes that were coming in, they wouldn't have been backported to Go 117, and therefore we might not be able to adequately support Kubernetes 124.
A side effect of the unfortunate delay was an unfortunate holiday situation where you were booked to take the week after the release off, and instead you ended up taking the week before the release off. Were you able to actually have any holiday and relax in that situation?
Well, I didn't go anywhere, if that's what you're asking.
No one ever does. That's what the pandemic's been. Staycations.
Yeah, staycations. It's been interesting. On the one hand, I've done a lot of Kubernetes work in that time, so you could argue it's not really been a holiday. On the other hand, my highly annoying friends have gotten me into playing an MMO, so I've been spending a lot of time playing that.
I hear also you have a new vacuum cleaner.
I've been following my Twitter. Yes, I couldn't find the charging cord for my old vacuum cleaner, and so I decided just to buy a new one. And I decided at long last just to buy one of the nice brand named ones, and it is just better.
This isn't the BBC. You're allowed to name it if you want.
Yes, we went and bought one of these nice Dyson vacuum cleaners, and the first time I've gotten one so expensive. And on the one hand, I feel a little bit bad spending a lot of money on a vacuum cleaner. On the other hand, it's so much easier.
Is it one of those handheld ones? I guess like a giant dustbuster with a long leg?
No, I got one of the corded floor ones, because the problem was, of course, I lost the charger for the last one, so I didn't want that to happen again. So I got a wall plug-in one.
I must say, going from a standard Henry Hoover to the place we're staying at the moment has a, what I'll call a knockoff Dyson portable vacuum cleaner. Having something that you can just pick up and carry around with you and not have to worry about the cord, it does encourage me to keep the place tidier.
Really? I think our last one was corded, but it didn't encourage us to use it anymore, just because it was so useless.
All right. Well, thank you very much for joining us today, James.
Thank you for having me. It's been great to be here.
You can find James on Twitter at James Leverack and on the web at jamesleverack.com. Thank you, as always, for listening. If you've enjoyed the show, please help us spread the word and tell a friend. If you have any feedback, please tell us. You can find us on Twitter at KubernetesPod or reach us by email at KubernetesPodcast@google.com. You can also check out the website at kubernetespodcast.com, where you will find transcripts and show notes, as well as links to subscribe. Thanks for listening, and we'll catch you next week.